Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Graduating from old school to high tech, pilots in Ukraine's Air Force will soon start to train on U.S.-made F-16s. Up till now, they've been going into battle in Soviet-era fighter jets. The training alone has boosted morale.
You're feeling adrenaline, and you're talking with your jet, like, please, let's do it.
Also today in the Southern Pacific, Papua New Guinea steps into the international spotlight.
Our foreign policy is basically enemies to none and friends to all.
But will they have to choose between the U.S. and China? I'm Marco Werman, and at the highest levels of professional soccer in Europe, racism continues to be a problem. The latest episode in Spain.
Spanish football is really disregarding overt racism in the stands.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us this Monday. Beijing is not happy. As the G7 summit wrapped up in the Japanese city of Hiroshima on Sunday, China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs summoned Japan's ambassador to officially express displeasure. China is accusing the G7 of, quote, smearing and attacking Beijing. The three-day meeting ended with a surprise visit from the president of Ukraine. The group of seven richest democracies pledged their support to Ukraine, with U.S. President Joe Biden giving his approval for Ukrainian pilots to train on F-16 fighter jets. From Tokyo, Julia Kim reports.
This year's G7 summit in Hiroshima, Japan, was rife with symbolism and surprises. Not least, the unannounced visit from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. His arrival on Saturday stole the limelight and prompted a major boost in support from G7 leaders. U.S. President Joe Biden announced a 38th package of military aid, this time for $375 million worth of ammunition, armored vehicles, and artillery.
Together with the entire G7, we have Ukraine's back, and I promise we're not going anywhere. So thank you for being here.
But that's not all. In a complete U-turn, the U.S. said it would pave the way for Ukraine to obtain F-16 fighter jets and help train Ukrainian pilots to fly them. After months of pleading for more air power, Zelensky told reporters that he was very pleased.
I'm very happy. Thank you very much. Thanks to our partners. It really will help our society, our people, to save houses, families.
I think it's a signal about the long haul.
Sheila Smith is from the Council of Foreign Affairs.
That this is obviously not going to be over soon, but that the Western support, and in particular U.S. support, because the U.S. support has been the largest of all, U.S. support is not going to go away.
The U.S. is also leading the way on sanctions targeting Russia's war machine. It's expanded the list to include export controls on some household goods like washer dryers to prevent them from being repurposed for the battlefield. But Russia wasn't the only country singled out.
China poses the biggest challenge of our age to global security and prosperity. They are increasingly authoritarian at home and assertive abroad.
That was British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. In their joint communique, G7 members issued a strong warning against using force to change the status quo in the East and South China Seas. They also made it clear that Taiwan's security is a global concern. But in the same document, member states stressed the need to continue cooperating with Beijing. Sheila Smith breaks down the G7's tricky balancing act.
None of those countries can afford to cut economic ties with China. But I think what the signaling is meant, I mean, what's meant by this sort of collective signaling is it's driven by Chinese behavior.
In recent years, China has increasingly used its economic clout to punish countries. South Korea, Australia, and EU member Lithuania were all slapped with trade sanctions after angering Beijing. But for the first time, G7 nations, without once mentioning China by name, called its tactics economic coercion. And President Biden says there's a plan to deal with such cases in the future.
We're not looking to decouple from China. We're looking to de-risk and diversify our relationship with China. That means taking steps to diversify our supply chains, and we're not dependent on any one country for necessary product. It means resisting economic coercion together and countering harmful practices that hurt our workers. It means protecting a narrow set of advanced technologies.
Biden's closing comments from the summit are yet another sign the West's relationship with China has entered a new phase of tension and suspicion. The question, according to analysts, is how are these major democracies going to be able to keep relations with the world's second largest economy while sticking to their word? For the world, I'm Julie Kim, Tokyo.
We'll hear more about the air war in Ukraine ahead this hour. President Joe Biden was supposed to leave the G7 summit and be in the South Pacific today. He had plans to be the first U.S. president to ever visit the island nation of Papua New Guinea, but he's canceled that leg of his trip to hustle back to Washington and deal with the debt ceiling deadlock. Instead, top U.S. diplomat Antony Blinken is there. And though Papua New Guinea's leaders are disappointed not to have the president, they're still pushing ahead with a controversial deal. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
For many years, the U.S. has paid little attention to Papua New Guinea.
I feel like, what would be the correct word? Yeah, maybe overlooked.
G.J. Milley is a political science lecturer at the University of Papua New Guinea. The nation gets overlooked because it's out in the Pacific, north of Australia, and it's not that wealthy. Anchorage, Alaska, has a bigger economy than Papua New Guinea, also known as PNG.
PNG, for so long, has not been at that world stage and had world recognition.
But that is changing. The Pentagon plans to start rotating U.S. troops to the island and put U.S. ships in its waters. The fine details aren't yet public, but PNG's Prime Minister, James Marape, says, "We are signing with the best military on the face of planet Earth." What's suddenly drawing the interest of the United States? That would be China. There's heavy Chinese investment in Papua New Guinea. China is also buying up lots of its oil and minerals. And there are rumors, perhaps false, of Chinese interest in having its own military presence on the island. Here's G.J. Milley.
Our foreign policy is basically enemies to none and friends to all. So I would think that they would like to keep that balance.
Papuan leaders would like to balance relations between the U.S. and China. In a recent interview with regional media, Marape, the prime minister, revealed more about this strategy.
We know which nations we deal in respect to security aspect and which nations we deal in terms of economy and trade. And China has been an important trading partner with us.
China is our big trading partner, he said. The U.S. is our big security partner. This is a win for the White House. America is struggling with China in the Pacific region, and both superpowers are trying to pull smaller countries closer to their orbit. India is also exerting its influence. In fact, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Papua New Guinea today, alongside U.S. Secretary of State Blinken. Modi even got the Papuan version of a red carpet greeting, a line of singing dancers. Papua New Guinea is clearly in the international spotlight. But I asked G.J. Milley whether this will actually benefit everyday people on the island.
For Papua New Guinea, the main thing would be the economic goal, I guess, because our country is really, in terms of economic situation right now, it's really dire.
As the U.S. plans to rotate troops to Papua New Guinea, Milley says regular citizens are asking, great, but will this create jobs? They have the same question for Chinese firms who come to build highways or gold mines and bring in Chinese workers. Milley says the power plays between the U.S. and China and India can feel removed from everyday concerns.
I don't think people are really concerned about, oh, we're going to partner up with this superpower. oh, we're going to partner up with China. People are looking for what would benefit them economically.
She says as Papua New Guinea's politicians bask in attention from world leaders, they would be wise to consider how all this could help or hurt everyday Papuans. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
$1.3 billion is a whole lot of money, and it is the size of the fine the European Union is imposing on the tech company Meta, which, as you know, owns and operates Facebook. The EU is punishing Meta for violating the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, letters you may be familiar with. $1.3 billion is a record fine for breaking GDPR rules, surpassing the one laid on Amazon in Luxembourg in 2021. To talk about what happened here, we reached out to Samir Jain. He's the policy director for the Center for Democracy and Technology. This fine was announced by Ireland's Data Protection Commission working on the EU's enforcement for the GDPR, Samir. What did Meta actually do to get hit with this record fine?
Well, in this case, the fine really relates to Meta's normal business practices. It's transferring data collected about Europeans to the United States, everything from photos to friend connections to direct messages. So this isn't a case involving some particular data abuse or doing something that they promised they wouldn't do. Here, it really has to do more with the transfer of data to the United States and broader policy concerns about whether that data is adequately protected, really, from the U.S. government and surveillance by the U.S. government. So while this case is about Meta, the reality is that the issues that give rise to this case could easily apply to lots of other companies that also transfer information about Europeans to America.
So on top of the $1.3 billion fine, is Meta being basically ordered by the EU to stop transferring data?
They're being given a five-month grace period before they have to comply, and they're almost certainly going to appeal, and so the court proceedings will take a while. But there is a preliminary agreement between the EU and the United States that would allow for this kind of transfer of data, but that mechanism is going to almost certainly be subject to court challenge, and so we will see what happens with that.
Samir, how does a company like Meta benefit from the data of users in Europe? Is it just a numbers game, like the more data, the merrier?
Of course, Meta makes money through targeted ads, and that includes ads that get targeted to Europeans, and targeting involves the use of data as well. So data is sort of the fuel on which Meta's business is run. So any restrictions on the collection or transfer of that data are going to have significant consequences for its business.
I'm wondering if you can take us back, Samir, to when the General Data Protection Regulation, the GDPR, was passed in 2016. A lot of us remember the start of checking boxes before accessing certain websites. What was going on at the time, and what was the rationale for the GDPR?
Well, the GDPR was really the first law in the world to try to take on the collection, use, and sharing of data. The Europeans said, we want to protect Europeans' data, so that means protecting it both here in Europe, but also making sure that when that data is transferred to another country, that the data itself isn't abused or used inappropriately.
Do you believe that Meta is looking after the user data that's being transferred to the United States and keeping it protected?
You know, one signal from this case and more broadly is the need for the United States to get its own house in order, both in terms of passing its own privacy law and then also, you know, making changes and reforms to internal surveillance laws, because it's really those surveillance laws, in particular, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that has given rise to the concerns that are what led to this decision by the Irish Data Protection Regulator.
Well, it's interesting, reacting to the $1.3 billion fine, Meta spokespeople commented that a fine this high could push us all towards a less global internet. What do you make of that argument?
I think there's some potential truth to it, depending on how the governments come together. In other words, you know, what is the internet going to look like 5 or 10 years from now? Are we going to continue to have an internet that's a very much a global medium in which users are able to connect seamlessly, in which data can flow to where it's needed? Or are we going to move to a world in which, you know, there's a United States internet, there's European internet, there's a Chinese internet, but we lose a lot of the power of the internet and the connections that it can build?
Samir Jain is the director of policy for the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thank you very much. This is really fascinating.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It has been the focal point of the war in Ukraine since last summer, the small, strategically insignificant city of Bakhmut. Over the weekend, there were conflicting accounts about the fighting there. Yevgeny Prigozhin, the leader of the private Russian Wagner militia group, issued a statement Sunday saying there is not a single Ukrainian soldier in Bakhmut. Ukraine's military disputed that and said its troops were still operating in parts of the city. President Volodymyr Zelensky, speaking in Japan, did acknowledge that most of Bakhmut is now in ruins.
They destroyed everything. There are no buildings. It's a pity. It's tragedy, but for today, Bakhmut is only in our hearts. There is nothing on this place. So just drowned and a lot of dead Russians.
Just ground and a lot of dead Russians. The fighting in Bakhmut began nearly 10 months ago. The city was once an industrial center in southeastern Ukraine, home to around 80,000 people. Now, drone footage shows a smoldering wasteland of damaged buildings. Both sides have lost large numbers of troops fighting over the city. Ukraine's defense of Bakhmut forced the Russian military to commit large numbers of soldiers to the area. The apparent Russian victory would be the first battlefield win for either side in many months. But the Ukrainian military also says it has broken through Russian defenses outside of Bakhmut, so it seems unlikely that the fighting in that part of the country is over. Aside from the ground battle in eastern Ukraine, President Zelensky says Ukraine's air defenses are a priority going forward. That coincides with a decision by the Biden administration to help train Ukrainian pilots to fly F-16 warplanes. In Kyiv, the world's Daniel Hoffman reports on the battle to control airspace over Ukraine.
In 2018, years before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin came out with a major military announcement.
Мы назвали эту систему «Кинжал». Видео, пожалуйста.
Speaking to the Kremlin elite, he unveiled a hypersonic ballistic missile that he said could travel at more than 5 times the speed of sound. He called it Kinjal, the Russian word for dagger, and said it was unstoppable. But earlier this month, he was proved wrong.
Ukraine claiming that for the first time, it shot down a Russian hypersonic missile, one of the most advanced the Kremlin has in its arsenal, with an American-supplied Patriot battery.
Ukraine's air defense had thwarted Kinjal. It was a big deal and showed what Ukraine could do with U.S.-provided air defenses. Valery Romanenko is a Ukrainian aviation and air defense expert.
Last year, we were able to hit only the Russian planes, helicopters, and cruise missiles. Now we can hit all the Russian types of attack weapon, ballistic missiles including.
Romanenko says air warfare in Ukraine is evolving in other key ways as well.
The Ukrainian-Russian war is the first war of drones. Russians use both attack and recon drones and are very dangerous for us.
Russia has often deployed these drones to damage Ukraine's electric grid. But in recent months, Ukraine has mostly withstood these attacks.
Our air defense confirms their high efficiency. For example, last 2 drone attacks, all 100% of drones were destroyed.
Ukraine isn't just defending itself from drones, it's also using them as a weapon. Yaroslav Markevich commands a drone unit in the northeastern city of Kharkiv.
Когда мы находимся на поле боя, нам очень важно дать точную обзорность.
Markevich says that at drone command centers like this one, they're able to provide intelligence to troops fighting on the front lines.
Благодаря использованию беспилотников.
They use drones to gather intelligence, he says. That info is then uploaded to a digital map that Ukraine's military uses. We can see our enemy's positions, Markevich says.
Ты реально работаешь эффективнее. Когда ты нажатием
As a result, our decision-making is much more effective, he says. Drones are also useful when soldiers are low on heavy ammunition.
Беспилотники сейчас начинают замещать артиллерию.
Drones are starting to replace artillery, Markevich says. They're rigged with grenades and other munitions that can be dropped on enemy positions.
Враг все это закрывает. силами радиоэлектронной борьбы.
But the enemy, Markevich says, is also adapting. Russia jams Ukrainian signals, which is the most effective way to take out drones. Markevich believes that drones are the future of modern warfare, but the military insists it also needs modern jets to win the war.
We needed to start the process like a half year ago, and nowadays we would have combat-ready pilots.
This 30-year-old fighter pilot goes by the name Juice. That's his call sign. He doesn't reveal his name because of security concerns.
At the moment, we have almost no air-to-air capabilities against Russian Air Force. We are absolutely not able to counteract Russian fighters and bombers because of very outdated radars, because of very outdated and not capable at all air-to-air missiles.
That's why Juice is so adamant that Ukraine needs modern jets, like the F-16. But until Ukraine has those jets in hand, Juice says that the country's fighter pilots will still manage to pull off some successful missions.
Usually it's like one mission per day, and you are ready to get in your jet like in a few minutes and just to take off as soon as possible to intercept these missiles or drones.
He calls it a multi-layered air defense system. Missile batteries try to shoot down Russian projectiles from the ground, and fighter pilots try to shoot them down from the sky.
You're feeling adrenaline, and you're talking with your jet, like, let's try, please, let's do it. Let's kill these missiles. Let's intercept them. Let's save the people on the ground.
Juice says F-16s would significantly improve his ability to hit incoming Russian missiles. He also says these jets will help Ukraine's offensive capabilities.
We can't just wait a miracle. We need to fight. We are ready to fight. We are trained. We are motivated. We need the tools.
After Biden's announcement in Hiroshima, it looks like Ukraine's pilots will get the tools that they've been waiting for. For the world, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kyiv, Ukraine.
Greece will take another go at elections in the coming weeks. Greek voters over the weekend gave emphatic support to Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. He's the center-right leader of the New Democracy Party, which got double the votes of the left-wing challenger. That's still not quite enough seats, though, for the prime minister to build a government on his own. But instead of building a coalition, Mitsotakis is pinning his hopes on an outright victory in the second round to be held sometime in the next 6 weeks. One other thing real quick, we're calling on all international students in the U.S. We want to know about your experience studying in the United States. Has it been what you hoped for? What are the upsides and downsides about going to school in America? No writing or research involved. Just record your thoughts and email us with that voice memo. The address is myworld@theworld.org. Tell us your name and location, and your comments may be the ones featured on an upcoming program. That email again is myworld@theworld.org. When it comes to Mother Earth, even the richest and most powerful people on the planet will meet their match.
Even though they have power, there's one thing they cannot combat, is Earth. You listen to it, you do something about it, or you don't. It does not matter. It's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
The force that is Angélique Kidjo and why it's garnered her one of the most important honors in music. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. Since 2018, when Brazilian soccer star Vinicius Jr. began playing on professional teams in Europe, he has endured racist abuse on the pitch. This week, the Real Madrid forward reached a breaking point. It all began before he even stepped off his team's bus for a match in Valencia. That's when fans of the opposing team greeted him with chants of mono, Spanish for monkey. The abuse continued from there. Afterward, Vinicius Jr. took to social media to complain that racism is normal in Spanish soccer. He said Spain was becoming known in his native Brazil as a country of racists. We got in touch with Piara Poar for some insight into what's going on. He's the executive director of the FAIR Network, an anti-discrimination network for global soccer. First of all, I want us to better understand what happened yesterday at the Real Madrid match in Valencia. I'm thinking specifically what occurred at around the 70-minute mark.
The game was full of monkey chanting and other racial abuse towards Vinicius Jr. Then a melee developed with players from the two sides, from Valencia and from Real Madrid. Two Valencia players, I think, could only do what only could be described as assaulting Vinicius Junior. One had his hand on his face, on his mouth. The other sort of grabbed him from behind. And then he pushed one of those players. And that resulted in a red card, so a sending off offense. He was sent from the field of play.
Vinicius Junior was sent off the field, is that right?
That's right, yes. And in fact, the two perpetrators were free to play on. I guess what we've seen here is another incident where the player who's been the victim of racism being sent off because, in effect, the reaction of players around him and his own reaction. Although it has to be said, he remained pretty calm. You know, he was angry, but he did not commit any acts of overt aggression or violence towards the opposition.
The crowd in Valencia waiting for the match to go on. Vinicius Jr. at one point confronted one of his abusers in the stands, I gather. What did he say or do at that moment?
It's difficult to know what was said between them, but, you know, it was an angry exchange.
It points to so much pain among these players. Has Vinicius Jr. in particular borne the brunt of a lot of this abuse?
This season, Vinicius has been abused now 11 times at different grounds, so it's not the same people who are the perpetrators. And at each of those 11 occasions, the action taken by the authorities, so here that would be the Football Association, the governing body, or the league, has been virtually zero.
This latest episode, though, this weekend, what have team owners and officials, and particularly the owners of Real Madrid, said about the problem and now that they've seen what happened to Vinicius this weekend?
Vinicius Junior's teammates have been very uncompromising in their support of him. His coach, Carlo Ancelotti, came out and gave a very strong statement. But then to counter that, you have the president of La Liga, who is a very influential figure in Spanish sport. He indulged in what you can only call victim blaming. He referred to Vinicius Junior's behavior and said that he should look at himself as well. Somehow this young guy, who is 22 years old, he is a footballing phenomenon, probably the best young player in Europe right now. He is, as we say here, scoring goals for fun. They are blaming his behavior. You know, they think that he somehow brings it on himself. That's their rationale.
I'm wondering what can be done to put an end to this abuse, Piara. Who should be held accountable?
The government should take responsibility. The Football Association in most countries is the ultimate head. And La Liga, which, you know, is a very celebrated league, says that they have no power to act. They can only make complaints, but in fact, it's their league. They could easily address their clubs, easily impose some sanctions of their own, and then put out a wider, more meaningful, more deep, far-reaching campaign to educate people about what's going on and why. You know, if you do that on the street, the police can be called immediately. If you do that in your workplace, then you're likely to face the sack. The issue is that nobody is telling them that this is not behavior that we want to tolerate, and nobody is showing them the sort of sanctions that will be applied. So it's something that reinforces itself. You know, generation after generation grows up hearing this being said and then repeats it. It's a very basic level of education that people need, but that is what we need to do. And it's clearly a reflection on the fact that the Spanish state isn't doing that job, but also, as I keep saying, a reflection of the fact that football isn't doing its job in setting out the standards of behavior that are expected.
Piara Powar is the executive director of the FAIR Network, an anti-discrimination network for global soccer. Thank you very much for your time, Piara.
Thank you very much.
New details are emerging from a United Nations report on the killings of civilians in the West African nation of Mali last year. The incident in question began on March 27th of 2022. Reports say military helicopters fired on people gathered in the village of Moura in central Mali. Soldiers arrived and thousands of people were detained. Over the next 4 days, some 500 people were killed in what a new UN report calls summary executions. Witnesses say there were armed white men working with Malian soldiers, and they were speaking an unknown language. Philip Obagi Jr. is a Nigeria-based correspondent who has been following the story. He's in Berlin today. First of all, Philip, what does the UN report actually say happened?
According to witnesses, you know, that spoke to the UN team that investigated this report, a military helicopter flew over the village of Moura, opening fire on people. And while four other helicopters landed and troops disembarked from these helicopters, now the soldiers corralled people into the center of the village, according to the UN, shooting randomly at those trying to escape. Now, some of these militants who soldiers claim to have gone after, now these militants are from a group known as Katiba Masina. It's an Al-Qaeda-linked group. Now, at least 20 civilians and a dozen alleged members of Katiba Masina were killed, according to the UN finding. Now, over the next 4 days, at least 500 people, you know, were said to have been summarily executed. That's what the UN found.
Now, Philip, we've heard of similar massacres, but not at this scale in Mali. It was a busy day in Moura, as you said, market day, lots of people there. Malian authorities, though, have denied that any civilians were killed. What have they said since this new UN report came out?
You know, they have been saying that the UN is partial. You know, so it's a point blank. It's a point blank rejection of this report, as far as, you know, the Malian authorities are concerned. They don't agree one bit with what the UN came up with.
Remind us just how big a threat extremist groups in Mali are right now, whether it's Al-Qaeda offshoots or any other kind of militant organization.
The threat is huge in the sense that you don't see, you know, much government presence in a lot of these communities where these Islamist groups operate. So what they do, they have created their own sort of government where they offer a lot of incentives to buy, you know, the trust of local communities. And it's expanding. And that's the concern that, you know, a lot of people have, because we're seeing cases where these insurgent groups are really, really, really delving into the hearts and minds of local communities. So that's a big concern.
Philip, what do we know about these so-called armed white men that witnesses say were working alongside the Malian troops in Moura last year?
Yeah, many people have already identified them as Russians, so-called Russian instructors, but we all know that these are actually mercenaries from the Wagner Group.
Has there been any reaction from the Wagner Group or their head, Yevgeny Prigozhin, or any statement from the Kremlin?
Not at all. You know, before now, we all knew that the Kremlin has always denied the existence of the Wagner Group in Africa. And it was only until recently that Yevgeny Prigozhin, the founder of the Wagner Group, even admitted, you know, to have a hand in this group, but he's been very, very silent.
How exactly is Wagner incorporated into the Malian army? Do you understand how that works?
It's the same model that, you know, the Russians have deployed in the Central African Republic, where oftentimes the Wagner group take the lead in terms of military command and instructions. So, yeah, it seems to be a situation where you have the Russians, you know, at the top of the command, and then you have the Malian armed forces just following the instructions and doing exactly what the Russians have asked them to do.
So, Philip, just to be clear, these Russian soldiers, are they Russian military or from the Wagner paramilitary group?
From the Russian Wagner group, mercenaries from the Wagner group.
Just to be clear, though, you're saying that it's the Wagner group that basically makes the orders for the Malian army and the Malian army follows?
That's right. So it's mostly instructions from the Wagner group, yeah.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, says what the report asserts could constitute war crimes and possibly even crimes against humanity. What are you going to be looking for next with this saga, Philip?
Well, we want to see more sanctions on the Wagner group. That will be key, because a lot of these operations have happened under their supervision. And, you know, you look at a situation where people are not just killed, but women are raped. There's lots of exploitations targeted at young people. So it's all classes of people who are affected. So yes, action has to be taken in the mold of sanctions, not just targeted at the Wagner group and possibly the Malian government as well.
Nigeria-based journalist Philip Obagi Jr. updating us on a report from the UN on mass executions in Mali last year that many believe were conducted with the collusion of Russian-backed Wagner group mercenaries. Thank you very much, Philip, for your time.
Thank you, Marco. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
From her first big hit to newer sounds, like this collaboration last year with Lebanese horn player Ibrahim Malouf. Angélique Kidjo never stops innovating and engaging with audiences around the world. Tomorrow in Stockholm, she'll be among three recipients of the Polar Music Prize, one of the most prestigious awards in music. Angélique Kidjo joins us. Welcome back and congratulations.
Thanks for having me back.
So the Polar Music Prize, I know it's been given out since 1992. It was created by a Swede, Stig Andersson, who is also the manager of ABBA. You join an impressive roster of past laureates and includes classical musicians and pop artists from Pierre Boulez to Paul McCartney. This year, you're honored alongside Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records, and Estonian composer Arvo Part. What does this honor mean to you?
Well, every honor that I receive means a lot. It means that the work I'm doing around the world in doing music, my advocacy and my commitment to the betterment of our shared humanity is acknowledged and is watched closely. And it's a sense of responsibility bestowed upon my shoulder for our world to be a better place for all of us to live.
Interestingly, this award pairs you with Chris Blackwell, who signed you to Island Records more than 30 years ago. And that track we heard a moment ago, Batonga, I mean, that's a sweet bookend.
I am so proud and happy to be with Chris Blackwell. He has been my A&R for the first 10 years of my career, and he had taught me a great deal about the business and always gave me my freedom as an artist to do whatever I wanted to do. So that freedom that he gave me have allowed me to become the artist that I am today. Receiving this prize with him, as you say, is a bookend.
The Polar Music Prize also nods to the work you do outside of music via the Batonga Foundation, your foundation, your role as a UN Goodwill Ambassador and your work on getting girls across Africa a solid education. I'm curious how you see that work right now, especially given setbacks to childhood education generally around the world with the pandemic. Is your job harder?
The pandemic has been, my God, it has been difficult. It's a reset button on which we are working fast forward, trying to catch up with. But we are still there, and we're still responding to the needs of the girls. And what I take out of there is that when you reach out to the girl and you make them partner to find solution to their problem, they are better. Because when you empower people to be free, to take lead in their own life, by doing so, they really protect and save all of the community.
So as I look at your schedule, Angélique Kidjo, for the next few months, it is grueling. And when you go on stage, you put it all out there. Combine that energy with your humanitarian work. I'm just wondering how you stay in shape and in focus. What's your secret?
My secret is eating healthy and working out. has always been since I was growing up in Benin, because I am asthmatic, like my mother. So my parents say, well, there's no way you're going to be crippled. You have to do sport. You have to run. You have to do things. So I used to run in the national athletic team, 1,500 meter every now and then, and also swim a lot. So I've always been that young girl that understand the importance of working out, to being healthy, to not to be a victim of my asthma, but to strengthen my lungs and to be aware of my body and the well-being of my body, is to know what to eat, when to eat, and to rest when I can. I mean, the rule of touring is eat when you can, sleep when you can. So I do that pretty well.
Don't ever let them hurt you in any way.
I'd like us to conclude with a recent performance you gave at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland in January. This is a song of yours called Mother Nature.
Mother Nature has a way of warning us. A time bomb set on a lost countdown. Do you hear it? Will you stop it? Won't you listen? We need each other now.
You were there on stage in Davos in front of a giant video projection of what looked like a writhing, mutating virus facing this audience of power players. And you're preaching. Mother Nature has a way of warning us. Will you hear it? Will you stop it? Will you listen? Angélique Kidjo, you're an artist who moves among some of the wealthiest people in the world and some of the poorest. Do you think policymakers and people in charge will listen?
Well, they will have to listen, because you know what? One thing that I realized for the last 2 decades traveling and being a witness of climate change in many different places I travel to, when you come back, things have changed. Is a reality that they cannot walk away from. And there will be nothing, absolutely nothing for them to lead if this earth decides to eject us. And that's the thing that I want them to understand. They have power, okay, but the power is given to them by people and Earth. Mother Earth does not discriminate. Rich or poor, it doesn't matter what language you speak. If it's have to, the tornado is coming or a tsunami is coming, no one, I say no one have the power to stop it. So therefore, I'm telling them their fragility, even though they have power, there's one thing they cannot combat, is Earth. You listen to it, you do something about it, or you don't. It does not matter. It's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
Angelique Kidjo, thank you very much for speaking with us again, and congratulations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Don't ever let them hurt you in any way. Oh, never let them steal and take the best of you.
Angelique Kidjo is one of three recipients of this year's Polar Prize. The award will be presented tomorrow in Stockholm.
Has a way of warning us. A time bomb set on a lost countdown. Will you find it? Will you stop it? Won't you listen?
Across the globe, a manicure means a lot more than just getting your nails done.
It makes me feel refreshed. It makes me feel edgy. It makes me feel bold, stylish, confident. So when I'm, you know, typing away at my keyboard and I have those bright and bold colors, I feel better about myself. I feel better about the day.
Journalist Zahra Hankir is a fan of getting her nails done, but when she sits down at the salon, she brings with her deep research into the cultural and political history of cosmetics. She's also aware of some of the recent health concerns around gel manicures especially. But Hankir accepts the risk. She argues that getting a manicure and wearing makeup are not just about beauty. They're also political acts.
Different types of makeup do have historical roots that stretch back centuries across different communities and cultures. And with manicures, you see that in ancient Babylonia, they were used before men took to the battlefields as a form of distraction. Ancient Egyptians used henna to decorate their nails. We saw the use of polish in ancient China as well with different compositions. So usually there may be other elements to it that have to do with honoring particular gods or protecting oneself from evil spirits.
Now, in your writing, Zahra, you also go into how certain nail styles can be viewed as a violation of social norms when worn, say, by a person of color, that people of color are often viewed differently for their choices. Talk more about that.
Sure. When a woman of color presents herself in specific ways in, let's say, a professional setting, she may be judged more harshly, let's say, than her white counterparts, in the sense that people may view her as being transgressive or attempting to make some sort of a statement in the way that she looks. And that does have roots in specific communities and cultures celebrating their beauty practices. And, you know, may also signify a rejection of Eurocentric beauty norms. We do see in the beauty industry in general that Eurocentric beauty norms are highly celebrated, whereas practices in communities of color are often appropriated. So I do think that there are many political implications to the choice of how we decide to present ourselves.
Yeah, what kind? I mean, can you give me an example of the implications?
Sure. I mean, I do. I could also point to certain communities around the world where, for example, women are judged harshly for how they look. So, in Iran, for example, the wearing of makeup or how women dress can actually be a form of rebelling against restrictions that are placed against them by the government. And as we've seen, as we saw in September with Mahsa Amini and her killing and then the subsequent protests,
in Iran,
how a woman presents herself in Iran, how a woman presents herself is actually quite a political statement. So it isn't surface level. She's deciding to present herself in a certain way and to rebel against certain restrictions that may be placed upon her.
Yeah, which leads to my next question. Nail polish can also be a political statement when worn by people who don't identify as women. Do you have any thoughts on folks who don't identify as women getting manicures?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look back centuries, both men and women and people of other genders in different cultures, such as the Hijras in India, have traditionally beautified themselves as well. And it can be an act of self-care. It can be an act of celebrating one's identity and one's culture. And that is not specifically unique to women. I mean, even in ancient Egypt, we saw both men and women beautified themselves in the same way because ancient Egyptians valued looks. And also beyond that, I do think in, you know, today with the trans community, non-binary community, they are also looking at makeup and how they present themselves as a form of self-expression that is not limited to necessarily the gender.
When you were younger, Zahra, growing up in a destabilized Lebanon, what was the importance of beautifying in that context for you?
I think for a lot of Lebanese people, or in general, just people who live in countries where there is some form of socioeconomic turmoil, that taking some control over the way that you exist in that society is actually highly valued. So you may want to get your nails done, and you may want to wear eyeliner, or you may want to dress in a particular way, even if there is turmoil around you, as a way of feeling that you have some control, as a way of self-preserving.
I mean, Zahra, you clearly love getting your nails done, and you know the risks. What are you going to do differently to prepare your hands before going under the UV rays next time?
I always actually wear quite a high SPF. I have actually started using gloves, which expose your fingertips. So that is a really good way to protect your skin. And I also always ensure that I'm going to a highly skilled technician. That's also quite important in terms of how you get the nails cured and how the polish dries. So, you know, there's always some form of risk in beautification. And this, again, this goes back centuries and cultures where, for example, in ancient Egypt, when people wore eyeliner, there was lead in that eyeliner. And other forms of risks have been taken by different communities across the ages, but they've continued to beautify themselves in different ways, because I feel like it's just human nature to want to look pretty.
When a manicure is not just a manicure. That's writer Zahra Hunkier speaking with us about nail polish as a political statement. Her forthcoming book is Eyeliner, A Cultural History. We began the show today in Japan, which just hosted a meeting of G7 leaders, and we leave you today with Sounds of Japan. This instrument is the koto in the capable hands of virtuoso Yumi Kurosawa. Inner Space is the title of this composition. It goes back to 2009. It is the very first piece she composed for the koto, a Japanese stringed instrument with a tradition that goes back more than a millennium. Kurosawa's new recording, Metamorphosis, is aptly named. It is an evolution away from Japanese tradition, but takes the koto to other parts of the globe and other musical idioms. Here, Kurosawa performs with Latin percussionist Carlos Maldonado on a track called One Day Monday. It's an homage to her adopted city of New York and its frenetic street life. But even before Maldonado makes his appearance on drums, Kurosawa sets up a jaunty rhythm on the koto. If there were musical borders before, Yumi Kurosawa has taken them down on Metamorphosis. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.